Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with North State and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wickman.
First responders are the action heroes of our time. Author Marilyn Woolley is a police and public safety psychologist and traumatologist who for the past 40 years has provided treatment to police, firefighters, dispatchers, medical personnel, and other first responders, and veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress injuries. Marilyn Woolley completed a PhD in 1977, and in 1979 began private practice in Redding, California. She has published articles in professional journals and presented papers at conferences. She volunteered for the American Red Cross to help victims of 9/11. In 2000, she published a novel, Jackpot Justice, the story of a fictional psychologist. In her new book, How Heroes Heal, Stories of First Responders and the Journey from Post-Traumatic Stress Injury to Post-Traumatic Growth, Dr. Woolley shares true stories of psychologically injured first responders and their transformation from wounded warriors to victorious heroes. Marilyn Woolley, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you begin your book by saying that you have been acquainted with PTSD your entire life. Now, how is that possible, Dr. Woolley?
My family history and, beginning with my grandfather, that's the first that I knew. And I didn't really know what happened to him until I was in my 20s after he was deceased. So basically the story there is that he was a brigadier general in World War II in Patch's army, went up through North Africa and France and Italy.
And a West Point, went to West Point.
Oh, he went to West Point. Yes, he was a West Point graduate and married my grandmother, a Southern Belle, which is another whole nother book. And what he did was, and I have thousands of his letters, literally, that he wrote from the war, but I couldn't always tell where he was because it was, of course, classified at that time. But he ended up in Dachau prison camp, and not as a prisoner, but as a liberator. And I didn't know any of this growing up. I knew, now that I look back, there were all the signs of post-traumatic stress injury, but of course I didn't know that. So what happened is he wrote a letter to my grandmother, and it begins, we took a little trip down to Dachau today, and then he proceeds to talk about the bodies stacked like cordwood and the 50 boxcars of bodies that he didn't get to in time. And so, definitely it was great guilt. And, he talked about giving people food and meeting this priest that survived by building the bricks for the crematoriums. It was just ghastly. And that just opened this whole new world for me. And shortly thereafter, I went to the Holocaust Museum in D.C. And you go up in this elevator to the fourth floor, and the doors open, and there's this like wall-sized photograph blown up bigger than life that shows the GIs looking in like you're in the concentration camp and they are seeing you for the first time. And they all have that 1,000-mile stare. And it was like a light bulb went off in my head that this is what happened to my grandfather. This is why he was so angry and so impatient and so wounded.
Yeah, it was not always like that, apparently, from what you gathered. When he was at West Point, they considered him a jokester.
Oh, yes. He had a great personality. He was known for being funny and having a sense of humor and playing tricks on people. And then, he married my grandmother, who was a beautiful woman. And he, was considered like the major catch. And so I'm sure, my father, when he remembered him from earlier, when he was in the military the whole time, pretty much. But, he remembers him as a kind, funny, you know, well-balanced person.
You mentioned you found this out. You said age 20, but why was this not known before then? You mentioned that it was after your dad died.
Yes. What happened is my dad died in 1992. And it's like I found the trunk in the attic. So this stuff was all these photos, albums of Dachau that my grandfather took or supervised having, you know, people taking them. I just opened the trunk and there it was. And it was like, what? And I knew he'd been in World War II, but nobody ever talked about it, which is typical of PTSD or PTSI. And so nobody ever told me. And until I found the trunk after my dad died, I had no idea.
Well, you know, these situations that you describe, so few people experience something that traumatic, that dramatic. But you also say that in your family, no one ever talked about meaningful things. And I think there are a lot of us that can identify with that, Dr. Woolley, that it wasn't just your family that
didn't
talk about meaningful things.
And there's many reasons for that. War experiences being one of them. I mean, the Vietnam vets. I mean, I think finally it's changing a little bit. We're understanding that you need to talk. I mean, you know, in order to process stuff, you need to talk. And if you don't process the stuff, you end up having all kinds of symptoms that aren't very helpful, you know, aren't healthy. So, you know, yes, lots of families have that. I would agree for various reasons, but it was, you know, it was just so rigid in my family that it was just known. And then, you know, what happened, just to show you, when my grandfather died, my father was at his house and he sent my father away. And my grandfather had been having heart problems all along. And he got all the funeral stuff out, all the burial stuff, all the insurance stuff, everything from the military, all the papers that he needed, everything, arranged them on the table, and then sat there and died. He didn't call 911. He didn't call my father back. He knew he was having a heart attack. But we don't talk about it. We don't ask for help.
My guest is a police and public safety psychologist and traumatologist. And she treats first responders. She has written a book, How Heroes Heal, Stories of First Responders and the Journey from Post-Traumatic Stress Injury to Post-Traumatic Growth. And you say, Dr. Woolley, at some point in your book, you say, this is the type of person I want to help. And what were the circumstances that caused you to know this is what I want to do?
Well, after I was still kind of dealing with all that stuff, my grandfather, I was in my late 20s, and I finished graduate school, got my doctorate, and through a number of circumstances, ended up at the VA hospital in Long Beach with Vietnam vets. And it just, things started falling together. The dots started connecting. I began to understand more what was going on with my grandfather and my family. I saw the symptoms. I saw what was happening to the Vietnam vets. They had spinal cord injuries. I started on that ward. And it just all started to click. And then there was an incident where they had grand rounds where they get a group of physicians together, psychiatrists, and they talk about a particular patient. So they brought this Vietnam vet in who they had, basically he was totally non-functional. He was, I think, under his couch. They had to drag him out from under his couch. They brought him in to be interviewed. And there was a young psychiatrist that was there who was doing the interview. And he was a few years older than me, you know. And most of the psychiatrists, the rest of them, were older, 20 years older. They had been Korean War era and more traditional psychiatrists. So this was in the late 70s, and it's before the diagnosis of PTSD was actually in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. So there was no PTSD diagnosis per se then. Well, the young psychiatrist started interviewing this poor Vietnam vet. And he was shaking. He was crying. He was losing control of his body. He could barely speak. And he started talking about he had been on reconnaissance in Vietnam, and meaning that he had been the one to go in and destroy villages. And he was talking about killing children. And I mean, it was a horrible interview. It was very, you know, I was riveted, but also it was kind of traumatic to hear it. And so then they took him out, and the young psychiatrist said to the other psychiatrist, "What do you think?" And they started saying, "Oh, he just wants three hots and a cot, meaning he just needs a vacation from being at home, or he's psychotic, you know, he's malingering, he's, you know," they just had all these diagnoses that had nothing to do with his experience.
And yet these are the people we rely on to understand us psychologically. And it was so sad hearing how they misunderstood this poor guy.
Well, this was in the late 70s. And we, you know, what were we doing? We were rejecting Vietnam vets at that time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, it was a different era. And the young psychiatrist finally said, "No, you're wrong. He is not psychotic. He is not, he is having something called," and I can't remember what he called it, but it was something to the effect of post-traumatic stress. And they said, "This stuff never happened. You know, how do you say that this, he's making this stuff up? This stuff obviously never happened. You know, didn't go into villages and kill people and all this stuff." And the young psychiatrist said, "Actually, it's true. And I know because I was there." So he had been in Vietnam. He'd seen it.
And then your conclusion was, if I truly listened to a person, my gut instinct would lead me to the truth.
Well, pretty much, yes. You know, I decided, I mean, that was a light bulb, another light bulb moment. I was like, these are people that I would like to reach. I would like to understand this. I would like to know what's going on. And of course, that has to do with my grandfather too. I was, again, the time in my life when I was connecting all the dots and understanding, you know, and part of it was, I want to understand what happened to my grandfather. Why did he change so much after his war experience?
Well, there was more than one person in your family who was traumatized, and you didn't know this for years until you casually one day mentioned DES. And what was that?
Oh, diethylstilbestrol. Yes. My mom took it, and I saw it on the cover of a magazine. I said something, and she just had this emotional reaction. And I was like, "What is the matter?" And, you know, they gave it to her so she wouldn't miscarry me, but it causes effects in the daughters. And I fortunately have been able to escape those. But, you know, she was traumatized, I think, also by, you know.
Because you say, when you were born, you only weighed 3 pounds.
Right.
And the doctors did not expect you to live. They told your mother, "This kid's not going to live, so don't even become attached to this child." And that was further trauma for your mother at that time, I'm sure.
Well, her mother had died, so she didn't have the support. And then they told her when she was pregnant that she'd miscarry. And then they said, "Yes, I would die." And I was in an incubator for 6 weeks. So she didn't, I don't know how much contact she had with me, but back then, not much, if any. So yeah, she again.
So it was shocking for you to see your mother's reaction to this casual remark that you made.
Right.
Mother had a meltdown.
Yes. Yes, she did.
But she had never told you that.
No. Again, we don't talk, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a very traumatic thing for her.
My guest is psychologist Marilyn Woolley, and her book is How Heroes Heal. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, psychologist and traumatologist, who is based in Reading and who have provided treatment to police, firefighters, dispatchers, medical personnel, and other first responders. Now, in that list, you mentioned firefighters, and we in Northern California know more than we would like to know about fires.
Yes.
So, you, of course, don't use the real names of the people in your book.
No.
And it was, and we agree with you, you say it was very courageous for these people to even tell their stories. And we're grateful to you and to them, the fact that they were willing to tell your stories, but obviously you don't use their real names. So this person named Leo is one of the stories that you tell. And what happened to Leo?
Well, he was one of the first responders at the car fire, and he was in Land Park, the neighborhood Land Park, when the fire basically jumped the river and came over and started burning all those homes. I mean, he was in it. He didn't know what he was in. He knew it was really bad. You know, the wind was blowing him over. He couldn't communicate with people that were just yards away from him. I mean, it was terrifying. And, you know, what his reaction was, it was something evil. It was something that wanted to kill him. So the psychological wound that he got from that was tremendous. And then also he saw one
Excuse me, you might remind us that this car fire was back in July of 2018.
Is 18,
when we're talking about. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And so what was Leo's experience?
Well, his sheer terror. Well, one of the things, I mean, he was afraid he would not be able to save people. I mean, they went into it thinking they were going to save houses, and within minutes they were thinking they would not be able to save the people that were in the houses. So just the pressure on him, the terror that he felt trying to do his job and just feeling helpless. And it's just kind of a formula for getting PTSI.
Which is, you might explain PTSI, because we're accustomed to hearing PTSD.
PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder, and that is a diagnosis that's in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And, you know, it's still used because it's kind of the official thing on the insurance forms and so on and so forth. But along the way, we started realizing that most of the diagnoses in there are something that happens within you. And with a post-traumatic stress injury, it's something that happens outside. It can lead to things that are in you, like anxiety, depression, you know, panic attacks, all that. But it starts outside. It's something external that happens to you. So post-traumatic stress injury is, I guess, a little more palatable, that it's not, there's something wrong with you. It's something happened to you. And, you know, that's kind of one of the things in the book, you know, what happened to them and how to recover from it. If it's an injury, it seems a little easier to recover from. Well, it's not easy, but, you know, recovery is more reachable than if it's a disorder that you just have.
Okay, so Leo is in his role as a firefighter, but it became more personal. What happened to Leo that made this all the more traumatic?
Well, in addition to that period, and it was quite a long period, you know, it was, you know, hours that he was feeling like he had to save people that he couldn't save, but he did save them. It was a very traumatic thing. Then what happened is one of his friends, Jeremy, who most people in Reading probably know who that is, Leo actually heard his Mayday call, but didn't know that it was him.
And Jeremy didn't recognize his voice.
Uh-huh. Didn't recognize his voice. It was so stressed. And what happened is Jeremy apparently got sucked up in the fire tornado, and, you know, his truck was thrown, and He was thrown out and died. He perished. There were other people that perished too. But I think for Leo, it was in particular because he knew Jeremy and had some connection to him. And later we went out and he took me to the site and we looked, you know, at what it looked like. And, you know, again, in Reading, I mean, the landscape was just kind of, I mean, the bark was off the trees. Everything was bare. Everything was black. There were big, huge electric towers that were crushed like pipe cleaners. I mean, it was really a sight to behold. I mean, that whole area, the devastation that the fire tornado took. And that, you know, it was what? A class F3 tornado, but it was made out of fire. So the devastation was incredible. And he showed me where they found Jeremy, and he went through his experience with it. And, you know, the truck was just kind of blown apart. And Jeremy's body was, you know, fortunately relatively intact. Well, you know, he was still dead. Anyway, it was very emotional for Leo. He, you know, it just hit him to the core.
My guest is a psychologist and an author. And she is a psychologist and traumatologist. And she has written a book, How Heroes Heal. And we so appreciate the firefighters, and we call them heroes, whether they want to be called heroes or not. But then you have somebody in your book, Francine. She doesn't put her life on the line. She doesn't go out and risk being shot or burned in a fire. She sits behind a telephone. And I'm thinking of Francine, a dispatcher. And how did Francine find herself in a situation where she needed somebody like you to help her?
Well, you know, I want to explain about dispatchers. They truly are the first responders because those are the ones that get the call. And they have to put out the information, and they have a lot of things going on. And, you know, they get the call, then they get another call, they get another call, and they never find out what happened. You know, when you're on scene, you know what happened. So they're sitting on that, wondering what happened, and they just take another call. So their job is really stressful. I mean, the thing is, I say, you know, the dispatchers are really the first responders because they get it first. They hear it first. They have to calm people down. They have to get information out of people. They have to relay information in a coherent manner. They have to take care, you know, they consider the first responders on the ground as their firefighters, their cops, and they have to take care of them. So they have a lot of pressure.
Well, Francine had a fear that probably started at age 5, and she happened to go to a house fire when she was 5 years old. And how did that happen? How did it come about that she, such a young child, would be going to a house fire?
Her father was a reporter, and her mother didn't want to be at home alone. So her father would just take the family, they'd be in the car. And, you know, in a way it was good, I think, because she kind of got used to things like that. And it was, you know, in her family, it was normalized. Not that it was normal, but it was just what you did, what dad did. He went out to report on these things. And probably in a way it set her up for what happened, you know, when she responded to her critical incident, it probably set her up for that. So, you know, she had to kind of work through that. It's like, how did I get here?
And you mentioned working through it because part of the title of your book, the subtitle is Stories of First Responders and the Journey from Post-Traumatic Stress Injury to Post-Traumatic Growth. And so you mentioned a retreat, West Coast Post-Trauma Retreat.
Yes.
And Francine found this helpful for her. So I'm sure you were the one who said, Francine, what about you try this? Is that the case?
No, actually, she found that on her own, which was good. I met her there. I met her, you know, we have kind of a community of people, and I met her there. And, you know, was interested in her story. She was in charge of, there were little girls that were kidnapped, and all but one was murdered when the one was left for dead. And her critical incident was that she thought she made a mistake by not responding to a call in time.
Yeah, that's something that recurs in your stories, is these people blame themselves.
Yes.
They, well, in her case, this harsh self-judgment. And even though when we as an outsider read the story, we thought, well, this person was not, it was no reason to feel guilty. It wasn't their fault. And yet they do.
That goes along with the job. They feel like they should be in control. They should be able to fix everything. I mean, that's one of the things that draws them into their career. And it's one of the
things. Desire to help.
Yes. And a real sincere desire. If they've been through trauma, and a lot of them have as children, they don't want anybody else to ever feel that way. They don't want anybody else to ever be hurt. And of course, when they do that job, it's impossible. You know, people are going to get hurt. I mean, sometimes the call is just messed up from the time you get it. So yeah, she felt very guilty. And that was the beginning of the end of her career. She, felt like she should have done something that was impossible for her to do.
Well, we just mentioned, in fact, you met her at this place called the West Coast Post-Trauma Retreat. And so she took advantage of that resource, but also she joined Al-Anon. Why did she need Al-Anon?
Her mother was an alcoholic, and she didn't realize that until much later in her life. And she had developed the pattern, as children of alcoholics often do, that she was responsible for taking care of her mother, hence everybody. And if something went wrong, it was her fault. So that set her up for this reaction that she had.
Yeah. And in this chapter, after you say we're talking about Francine was a dispatcher, events that are prolonged and end with a negative outcome. And so a lot of these things, like Leo, there was this fire. This was all happened pretty rapidly, in fact.
And well, case, I would and say it was prolonged, and it wasn't just an instant, it was hours and trying. But yeah, I mean, they overlap. It means incidents have different components to them. But okay. So yeah, Francine's went on for hours, like I can't remember exactly, but I think for like a day. And then she didn't talk to anybody about that, really. So she carried it with her. So that's what happens. They feel this guilt. They feel like they didn't do a good job. They were out of control. They didn't fix it. And they don't talk to anybody about it. And it gets in their brain and stays there and destroys their self-confidence.
Well, you bring up in this chapter about Francine, adrenaline addiction. And how does that affect people?
Well, you go call to call. Every time you go to a call, you have another adrenaline rush. The thing with adrenaline rushes, you go up, but then you come way down. And it is like a drug. I mean, it is, you know, it is. And you want that high, because when you are in that high, you don't have to feel your pain, because you're on automatic. You're doing your job. You're focusing on, we call it operational mode. You're focusing on the issue and not your own psychological pain.
Well, I mentioned that sometimes a lot of your book, you are telling the stories of people who have unusual circumstances, but that those of us ordinary humans, more or less, can say, oh my gosh, this is a lesson I could use. And I really liked when you were telling Francine's story, that she learned gratitude.
Yes. And to this day, she's currently one of the chaplains at WCPR. And she always preaches gratitude, and it's always very good.
How do we do that? What does the practice of gratitude entail?
Well, basically looking for things in your life that you're grateful for. I mean, most people have something. And, you know, just to focus, I asked my husband in the morning, what are you grateful for today? And, you know, this morning he said, peace and quiet. So, you know, just focusing on what is going right in your life, because it's really easy to focus on what's going wrong and to get caught up in worry and fear and anxiety and so on and so forth. And so, you know, the theory is that you just kind of switch that. You look at what's positive, which can be very, you know, it takes a while to get used to it. And I think what she says is five things in the morning and five things in the evening that you're grateful for. You know, write them down, think about them, you know, make your mind do that rather than thinking about negative things.
In fact, maybe that's the question. We see a friend, we should pose the question more specifically and saying, what are you grateful for today?
Yeah.
So that's something we can learn from Francine's experience.
Yes, yes.
Now, you mentioned that in the first responders' bodies, something is going on because we think this is all mental, all psychologically. But you say that there were things going on psychologically and physically in these first responders' body. How do you deal with that, Dr. Woolley?
Well, you know, what I do, one treatment that I do is to get them to focus on what's going on in their body, because these people are used to action. They're used to going out there, you know, they're, you know, large and in charge, and they don't focus on what is happening internally. And many times because they're afraid that they'd be judged, that they'd be weak, or you know, they don't think anybody would understand. And so one thing I try to do is get them focus on what's your stomach doing? What's your heart rate? What's your skin doing? You know, how are you breathing? Because then they can start connecting that with the symptoms, the other symptoms that they're having. And really, if you think of it, post-traumatic stress injury is a body-wide, you're on fight or flight. So it's a body-wide response. Every cell in your body is reacting to this because your body's job is to keep you alive. And it doesn't know if it's a tiger or a car wreck or a fire or what it is. It just knows that your body's in danger. And so everything is heightened.
Well, you tell stories in your book about these various first responders. But when I turned and opened your book to the dedication page, I saw you refer to somebody named Bill Baxter as your angel.
And
I thought, that seems like there's a story there.
Yes. Actually, Bill Baxter is Max. And I hope I can get through this. I met him in the early 2000s at WCPR.
WCPR, by the way, West Coast Post-Trauma Retreat.
Oh, West Coast. Yes, I met him there. And he was... he had just survived a helicopter crash. I mean, the scariest thing you ever heard when he describes his helicopter crash. And he was broken and bruised and in the hospital for months. And I had responded to that accident and done a debriefing, a critical incident stress debriefing with the crew and the other people that were working there. There was like 90 people and they were all traumatized by this helicopter crash. So I talked to them, that's part of what I do. And so then months later, I go to WCPR and here's Bill. And I was like, oh my God, I was there. I know what happened. And we just bonded. And he did a tremendous amount of work. I mean, a tremendous amount. It was just amazing what he did over the years. He just became a whole new person. And he had always been kind of, you know, very compulsive. But at the same time, his guilt was that he had a feeling that the helicopter wasn't loaded right. And he didn't say anything. And then that helicopter crash happened. So one thing he learned is to really talk about things, express your feelings. So what he always called me his angel, because I guess I was that first person that he met there at WCPR. And, you know, I knew all about the thing because I had been I had done the debriefing, we, you know, with the Cal Fire team. It was we had a team that we would go out and do critical incident stress management with these.
Well, here's a case too, when this pilot shouldn't have been flying this helicopter, but right. Bill blamed himself.
Again, yeah. You know, and I think his parents were alcoholics too. And I think that he, you know, again, he took on everything. He took on everything. And so I just through the years, and I saw him just a couple of months before he died. Through the years, I just saw his growth and how he had gone from, you know, shaming himself, feeling guilty, feeling inadequate, to this man that was really taking care of himself. I mean, he got into nature. He would do a lot of hikes. He was volunteering, doing things. He was just like a changed person. And, you know, then what happened is he got a brain tumor and died very quickly. So every time he saw me, he would say, "My angel, my angel." So it's kind of like now he's my angel.
Well, to read Bill's story, Bill is called Max in your book, and he's chapter 3 of these stories. Max, serious line of duty injury, and his injury was very serious, but he was an inspiration, and you call him your angel.
Yes, now he is. He has really inspired me, taught me a lot.
Well, one thing that interested me also that I think the rest of us can pay attention to, you say that children can react to childhood trauma and yet not be able to access those memories like a mature adult might. And sometimes you wonder, adult that you hear their story and you wonder, my goodness, what was their childhood like? So how do you deal with that, Dr. Woolley?
Well, again, this goes with, you know, teaching them to react or to understand what their bodies are doing. So what I do is, I mean, it takes a while because usually first responders don't want to feel their bodies. You know, they want to be in control. And when they feel what their bodies are doing, they don't feel in control. So it takes a little bonding and coaxing and, you know, teaching them. I mean, the reason I talk about it as a journey is I try to make it kind of an adventure. You know, or a quest. It's like, okay, every day you go out there and you fight. You're the heroes that the rest of us would like to be or, you know, fantasize about. But your journey is going inward. Your journey is going to look at how your mind reacts, how your body reacts. So what I do is talk about their bodies and what they're feeling. And I say, when have you felt that before? And they said, well, you know, a year ago. And then earlier, you keep going back. And it's amazing how many times you find they have a childhood memory that they've suppressed and that they haven't wanted to think about and they haven't dealt with. And the body feeling comes up then. And that's the thing, a lot of times, that has set them up for their reaction to whatever the critical incident or incidents were.
Let me remind people, the name of your book has that word journey in it, How Heroes Heal, Stories of First Responders and the Journey from Post-Traumatic Stress Injury to Post-Traumatic Growth. After a break, Dr. Woolley and I will be back to continue our conversation about first responders. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. And I'm back with psychologist and author Marilyn Woolley, whose book is How Heroes Heal. And I remember back in the day, Joseph Campbell, he focused on the hero's journey. And was that an inspiration for the title of your book?
Yes, actually it was. The way I came up with this concept is I was volunteering as a clinician at WCPR. And I was also, that's also around the time I had just finished my fiction book, my murder mystery, Jackpot Justice. And I was taking classes from this brilliant screenwriter named Chris Vogler. And he was based on Joseph Campbell and talked a lot about Joseph Campbell. And one day, literally, I'm driving another light bulb. I have lots of light bulbs. And I thought, that's what's happening with these first responders. They're not doing, they're already heroes on the outside. Where they need to be heroes is on the inside, the psychological things that are going on with them. And the reason that they're getting so, that they have so many problems and issues is they haven't done the inner journey.
Which takes more courage in a way. Yeah. I mean, these are people who can put their lives on the line, go out and fight fires or a highway patrol. You tell a story of a highway patrolman. And yet, this inner journey that you are encouraging takes so much courage also, of a different sort.
Yes. This is where you're really a hero, is when you go in and focus on this stuff and learn about yourself. That's the real hero's journey. You know, you can do that other stuff all day long, but this is what is really going to impact your life. And it's the hardest thing you will ever do.
So in her book, Dr. Marilyn Woolley shares true stories of psychologically injured first responders and their transformation from wounded warriors to victorious heroes. So one of the ways they go about this is going to this West Coast post-trauma retreat. But you also have some other interventions for dealing with PTSD and triggers. And one might surprise people. There's an eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And how can eye movement play a role in this as an intervention?
And this came about in the early 90s. I've been doing it actually in Reading. There was a psychologist in Reading who knew the person who came up with this, Francine Shapiro. And so we were one of the first groups trained. And, you know, we went to the training, and at first I'm thinking, okay, this is weird. But it works. It's amazing. And, you know, I think everybody in the class that took it, we used it, and we've all used it for all these years. And so basically what it involves is it doesn't really have anything to do with eye movement anymore. The way Francine Shapiro, she was a psychologist, came up with it is that she was really upset about something. And one day she was outside and she started moving her eyes back and forth. And all of a sudden she felt better. And she was a genius at getting this information out. And she started this, you know, huge movement, training people and, you know, training trainers to train people. And there's just been a bunch of research on it. And I mean, tremendous amount. They've done, you know, fMRIs to see what happens to the brain. And there really are changes in the brain when you do it. And so, yes, it's now what we do bilateral stimulation, because it doesn't have to be your eyes. It just has to be something going back and forth. So you can tap. I have what I use in my office. I use the tappers, and you hold a little thing in each hand and it buzzes back and forth. Or you can do using earphones or use a machine with your eyes. I mean, we used to sit here and do it with our hands for hours. And it was just like, oh my God, we've got to find something else. I can't keep moving my hand back and forth, you know, to help this person. And there's other things that have come out. There's brain spotting. There's emotional freedom therapy. So there's all kinds of other kind of collateral therapies that have come out.
Well, you mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy, and I think that's common enough that people probably have heard of that, unlike the eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. But how do you use cognitive behavioral therapy, Dr. Woolley?
Well, basically, again, you know, that has with what I do is I incorporate that with the body work. And basically, you're looking at thoughts and your reactions to thoughts. And there's various kinds of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. But you're examining somebody's reaction, how they're thinking about it, what's going on in the body, and helping people make sense of their reactions. And I think when people understand what's going on, it's a lot easier to cope with it.
My guest is a psychologist and traumatologist who for the past 40 years have provided treatments for police, firefighters, dispatchers, medical personnel, and other first responders and veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress injuries. And there's one person, you call him Dylan in your book, that occupies two chapters. And why did it take two chapters to tell Dylan's story?
He had so much happen to him. And, you know, he was witness to a colleague who suicided, which was very traumatic for him and set him up for all kinds of issues. He also, to cope with his symptoms, he developed an alcohol problem, which fortunately almost destroyed his life, but didn't. And then at the end, just what he went through to look at how that incident and other incidents had affected his life had almost, I mean, he really came close to losing his life. And to losing his family, and you know, he finally retired, but he was very traumatized, and there were all kinds of layers. Like, you know, why didn't somebody help this guy? How did this happen? What should I have seen? How should I have known about it? And so on and so forth. So I really felt like I needed to end with his post-traumatic growth. I mean, it really was a great growth for him.
Well, and when we read your book, we can see why first responder suicide is such a huge problem.
Yes. There are more suicides than there are line of duty deaths in many cases. So more people die from suicide with firefighters, wildland firefighters, and cops than actually die in the line of duty.
Line of duty. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you, in your book, refer to the structures of the brain because it helps to understand the structure of a human brain when we're reading your book and when you refer to these different parts of the brain. And what, just briefly, should we know about the brain to understand what you've been telling us, Dr. Woolley?
Well, to make it simple, I mean, you have different parts of your brain. You have a cognitive part. And you have an emotional part, we call it the dog brain. And then you have the part that we call the alligator brain, the key basic life functions. And they all interact. But when a stimulus comes through, it enters a part of your brain called the thalamus. And everything goes through there except for smell, which goes directly, to your brain. And your thalamus routes that information to various places. So what happens when you have post-traumatic stress or react to a really horrific stimulus is it goes to your amygdala. Your amygdala is the part that tells you, you know, fight or flight, right? And then it routes to the hippocampus, which has to do with memories and putting meaning to memories. And then it goes up to your cognitive part. So, you know, ideally what happens is a tiger jumps in your office and you immediately go into fight or flight. But then you can say, okay, I don't need, I can throw this chair at the tiger and I can be safe. So the cognitive part kind of mediates that. But what happens is, and people don't understand this about law enforcement, what happens is you actually react faster than you even know anything's happening. It takes a little while for the information to get up to the cognitive part. And so you're reacting right away. You're reacting. For example, I watched a video of a cop that confronted a guy with a hatchet. The man hit the hatchet. And so the cop jumps out of his car and starts to move towards this guy because he was around people and it was going to be a really dangerous situation. And he ends up having to shoot him because the guy was really dangerous and had a hatchet and was going to hack people up. So in his statement to me, he said, "I drew my gun when I was about 20 feet from the guy." And you look at the video, he drew his gun right after he got out of the car. He didn't even know. He hadn't even, his conscious mind had not even recognized the nature of the threat yet. And his body had already reacted. So a lot of the things that we see with cops, I don't want to, get into politics or anything, but this is the body reaction.
Well, I think we learned a lot in your book about acquaintances, friends, family, and ourselves when we read your book. Let me remind people again. So thank you, Dr. Woolley. My guest has been Marilyn Woolley. She's a Reading-based psychologist and traumatologist, and her book is How Heroes Heal, Stories of First Responders and the Journey from Post-Traumatic Stress Injury to Post-Traumatic Growth. Thank you, Dr. Woolley.
Thank you. This is great.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.